All right, there we go. Just getting a text message there, sorry. I had to turn those off on my computer when I'm teaching. squirrel! Okay, so we have to go over the lab curriculum a little bit, my ideas of what's gonna happen in lab, and then do sort of an introduction in terms of what we're gonna do with our first lab if everything works out the way that I anticipate it's supposed to work out. So that's kind of the goals. And you've already had an introduction to me from lecture, so you're familiar with the website that I have and the Canvas shell and all of those things. So let me jump in. Let me do a screen share. And I guess I got to stop this one and do a different one. I'm always impressed when I see web talks on Zoom, and they just effortlessly switch back and forth between windows. And when they screen share, they always screen share just that one window. And I don't know how they do that, because when I go to hit screen share, I've got 50,000 windows open. And to find that one window, like right now, I can't even find the Zoom app in all the windows that I've got open. To find that one window that they switch to so effortlessly, makes me crazy how they just make that work and it looks flawless. But I think that's because I've got two screens and I'm always working at the same time that I'm got all my teaching stuff up. So I've just got a bazillion things open in the background. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to go to chemed.study and go to the laboratory page and the laboratory syllabus. So as I said, my vision for lab in this virtual sort of format is to give a lab lecture, a traditional sort of lab lecture like we would have done in person if you were to actually do the lab, and then to have a video posted where you guys watch that video on your own time rather than taking up class time to watch the video. In the next class session, after you have watched the video and taken down the data from the video, then to do a data review and sort of wrap up of any questions that came up during the experiment, what you actually saw during the experiment, how to deal with the data taken during the experiment, and the write-up that I want from that. And then the class after that, we would have a review session for lecture, which would give you some time to process and write and to work up the components from lab before proceeding into the next lab, so they're not just piling up on top of each other, trying to be cognizant of not putting too much workload onto you guys all at one time. So the syllabus, as I've got it here, has all the same information that the other syllabus has, same office hours, same everything, same website. The hours for the morning section and the afternoon section, the morning section is going to be from 9 to 11, the afternoon section from 3 to 5. And there will be no final for this class. Traditionally, what we do in the lab class is we do a lab cleanup, and everybody comes back in during finals week during our prescribed lab time. And for 3 hours, both sections have separate lab finals, and both sections go through and they clean the lab up. They check out of their lockers. Some people are cleaning fume hoods. Some people are cleaning other areas of the lab and just making sure that all the equipment gets put back away and the whole thing gets all tidied back up. So I generally don't have a final for the class in the traditional sense of a final. And so once we get done and you turn in your last write-up, that'll be the end. There won't be an actual exam. I don't anticipate any exams or quizzes for lab. I just anticipate the write-ups and the workups of the labs themselves. Okay. The book that we use for the lab is Pavia. It is the only textbook that is generally required for the lab. It has all the instructions for the labs that we're going to be doing. That's still a valuable book if you didn't purchase it and don't have Pavia. I know that there are some online sources of that thing floating around. I think I even have one myself that I can kick out as a PDF. It's just not going to be super critical. There are some things that are in the back of the book, technique-wise, that are really, really good, but they're really, really good when you're in lab. They're not so good when you're just reading them and you're not actually working in lab or working in that way. And in regards to a hardbound laboratory notebook, I anticipate having you guys take data from the video lab in the same way that you would in class. However, that hardbound laboratory notebook could be just about anything at this point, because you're just going to be taking notes from the video itself. You can take an old composition book that you've got that has half of the book still left that's empty in the back, and that's a perfectly good thing to use, and just repurpose it, turn it into a lab notebook, and take notes on it from there. So I try not to have you guys spend money if it's not really absolutely necessary. So don't worry about anything too special with the hand with the hardbound laboratory notebook.
And then, you still want it to be hardbound?
It doesn't have to be. No, it's just the idea between a laboratory notebook, and maybe I should tell you guys a story. There's my notebook. Okay, so the laboratory notebook, when I went through undergraduate, I was not taught how to do a laboratory notebook in a particularly rigorous way. And when I went and became a graduate student, I worked on an extremely valuable project. I worked on a project that was a company called Palco that was in Scotts Valley. And they came to UCSC and they pitched a project that they wanted my professor, my mentor, to work on. My mentor's name is Bogdan Singerong. And Bogdan is a boron chemist. He was a postdoc of H.C. Brown, who won the Nobel Prize for certain boron reactions, asymmetric boron reactions. And so Bogdan is a very, very world-renowned, prominent boron chemist. And Palco was a company that designed equipment for people with diabetes. And they had many different types of equipment that they designed and sold. And what they wanted Bogdan to do was to work around certain patents that patented technology to do glucose sensing for people who have diabetes. And what they wanted to make was an implantable fluorescent glucose sensor that would be implantable in the body and dynamically be able to read blood glucose measurements. And so I got put onto that project as a grad student. And I was the second student who was put onto that project and very quickly took the lead in that project. And I discovered outside of what I was being asked to do, a sensing mechanism that was not patented and was a novel sensing mechanism. And we actually patented that sensing mechanism. And then that device went on to actually spawn a company called Glumetrix. And then Glumetrix was sold out to Medtronic. And the device has progressed to the point where it has passed phase 3 clinical trials, and it's actually being used in hospitals and emergency rooms, and it gets implanted within patients that are in critical care so that they can dynamically measure their blood glucose levels ongoing throughout the day at any time. Eventually, they're hoping that it will make it all the way into a consumer product and be implanted like a pacemaker and just relay out to a watch, and you can just have an alarm that would tell you exactly what your glucose levels were or when they were crashing or when they were too high. And the problem was that my discovery that led to all of that, I didn't keep my notebook the way that I was supposed to as a legal standard. And so this project was deemed to be so valuable that other people that were involved in the project did not want graduate students on the patent. Bogdan had always had a policy that the graduate students who work in the project are always on the patent. And if you look back through his many, many patents, you'll see nothing but graduate students until you get to the glucose project, and then there's no graduate students. So Bogdan and I had a bit of a falling out, and I initiated legal proceedings to try to show that I did that work that was outside of the of what I was being asked to do. And the problem was is that I didn't keep my laboratory notebook in the way that I was supposed to. So that didn't happen. Bogdan and I have since patched things up, and I have the utmost respect for Bogdan. So let's put that forward going forward, that Bogdan is a fantastic PI, and it really was not his it really was not him that was pushing things the way they went down. But that's just the way they went down. And so I have in my curriculum a pet peeve about laboratory notebooks and teaching how to do it the right way. I think it's incredibly important. It's important to protect your personal technology. It's important to protect the company's intellectual technology. And so learning how to do a laboratory notebook the right way is an important skill set. Now, many of the laboratory notebooks these days are done digitally rather than being done manually, but it's the same skills, the same process, and all the same things need to be done, whether it's digital or hardbound. It's just a lot easier for us to do sort of a hardbound book right now. And I haven't invested a tremendous amount of energy in learning how to do the electronic notebooks. And I just didn't want to have to have an added expense beyond a $5 notebook is kind of the way that I think about that. So the notebook, I think, is an important skill. And I still want to teach you guys the correct way to take notes in a laboratory notebook and the correct fields that are supposed to be there and things. And to that end, it's a large part of my teaching. And I have a laboratory notebook rubric that details how to do all of those things that I grade the laboratory notebook on. So we could spend more time talking about that a little bit later. They sell a version of this book that is in the bookstore. I think it's no more than $5 or $6. And it's hardbound, but it is not a hardcover. It's a soft cover, flexible book. But the pages, when we say hardbound, what we mean is the pages are not meant to be torn out. So in some of the laboratory notebooks that you get, they have perforated pages such that you could tear out copies and hand in copies. And some of the composition books have perforated pages where they can be torn out. That's what I'm trying to distinguish between, is something that is hardbound but is not perforated. And then this book, the reason that I like it is because it has all of the fields in the book that are appropriate. It has titles and dates and to and from. It has witnessing fields and dates and invented by and recorded by, and it's just a professional laboratory notebook, and it has all the fields of a legal document that it should have. So if you want to grab the one at the bookstore and you have a couple of bucks to throw at it, not a bad idea, but I also don't want people to spend money. So if you have a lab book that is from Chem 1A or Chem 1B and it has empty pages in it, by all means, use that lab notebook. Let's just make use of it. It's a perfect thing to do. Or an old composition book would work just as well. Just ink in the numbers, number the pages, and away we go. So that's sort of that thing. Maria.
Able to get on the patent or?
No, I was not. It's the way those things go sometimes. It worked out for the best, because if I were to have gotten my name on the patent, I probably then would have actually followed through with that. And I probably would have followed through in industry, and I would be in industry now rather than teaching. And I'm really not suited for industry. I work far too slow for industry. I'm very systematic. I like to know exactly what it is that I'm dealing with. And I just don't work on an industry timescale. So when I tell you something and I tell you it can work and I do it in the lab, you can bet it works and know that it's going to work 100%. But it's going to take me longer to do it than it would take most people, just because I'm going to be very careful about how I'm doing it. So, and I'm in a much better place. Academia and Cabrillo have given me a wonderful career, and it has allowed me to pay back from my time at Cabrillo and being a student at Cabrillo. And I think that has meant the world. So I don't lose sleep over it anymore. Used to, don't use sleep over it anymore. All right. Let's see. So syllabus wise, those are the materials. And then the difference between first semester and second semester in content is second semester, we start doing larger projects. In first semester, the idea behind the curriculum there is to teach you all the skill sets to be a bench chemist. So we teach you initially starting with solubility and looking at the solubility of compounds, and everything starts from solubility. Then we teach you how to recrystallize things. We teach you how to do filtrations. We teach you how to do separations, all the different techniques that we go through and teach thin layer chromatography. And it's just a lot of different individual skill sets. And so I think of first semester as the skill set sort of section. And then second semester is where we do project-based experiments. So they're not generally one-offs. Sometimes they are, sometimes it's just a single thing that we're making that is upping your skill set, like the Grignard. The Grignard that we do as the first experiment is a very challenging experiment because it's an organometallic and it's a very strong base and you have to be super careful in how you handle it. It's extremely sensitive to water and moisture. And so you need to be careful with how you put your glassware together and how you handle your glassware and keeping everything dry. Putting it together in an expeditious manner so that it doesn't have time to acquire water when the glassware comes out of the oven, which is how we keep water out of the reaction. And then we get into experiments where they're multi-step, where you make a product and then that product is used to make another product and then that product is made to another product. And each time you lose a percentage of your material that you're working with because your yield decreases the amount that you have to move forward with. So the goal there is by the time you get to the third reaction to have enough material to be able to do successfully the third reaction. And then all of these are designed together to give the student an experience and confidence to be able to tackle special projects, which is sort of a mini research project that we do. And that research project doesn't mean that we do unique never done before experiments. It means that we do experiments that are much more challenging and out of the regular curriculum. And I let students choose their own experiments. And we do a lot of research online through the UCSE Science Citation Index. And we find published papers on procedures that we would like to try to reproduce, either a small synthesis that is three steps maybe, or an isolation of a natural product that we can order the plant material from someplace and we isolate out that compound. Or maybe it's an antibiotic that we either synthesize or isolate and we coordinate with biology and we actually test that antibiotic on bacterial strains down in biology. And so there's many things that that project can look like. And the whole goal is to try to increase the student's skills enough to be able to tackle those special projects. Now, all of that is difficult because we're in an online format here. So my idea is to, this is not where I need to be, schedule. My idea is to go through and to do each of the experiments in a virtual way where I film the experiment and we go through and we talk about the skill sets and how to do the experiment and why we do things. Trying to give you as much detail as I can so that you can see what the skill set entails. And then when we get to the area that would be special projects, which is traditionally after spring break, I have a lot of to be determined because I don't know what this is going to look like yet. And I didn't attempt to do special projects last semester, but what I did do was some computational chemistry. And there's the ability to do special projects computationally that could be interesting, depending upon your attitude towards computational chemistry and your ability to be able to do computational chemistry using the WebMO server. So there are things that we can do rather than just taking a molecule and calculating out a molecule, we can actually calculate out transition states. And transition states are extremely difficult to calculate. They can't be visualized. They can't be done any other way than computationally. And so it presents an interesting challenge to do some research on some reactions or a reaction to find a reaction of interest and to look at reproducing the transition state that governs that reaction through computational means. It requires trial and error. It will definitely involve failure. It will definitely involve learning and hopefully it would involve some success and some learning of some new skill sets in the process. And so I think that if you're willing to give it a shot when we get to that point, I think that there are definitely some things that we can do that would be interesting, even though we can't have a hands-on experiment. So I think there's some things to look forward to. So the experiments that we do, like I said, we start off with a Grignard. That's an organometallic reaction that I'll talk about more today. I'll put up the video for it that I'm going to go shoot tomorrow, and we'll see how that goes. That'll be interesting. And then we'll do a data analysis on Tuesday of that experiment. And then Thursday, we'll have a review session for lecture. And so in that, we'll steal a little bit of lab time, which also gives you guys some working time rather than constantly barraging you with lab stuff and new experiments. That gives you some time to catch up and process and work through that data and start some sort of write-up that will be turned in for the Grignard experiment. Then we start a synthesis. This is a multi-step synthesis, the synthesis of benzoin. We use benzaldehyde. Benzaldehyde is converted into benzoin in the first step. And then benzoin is converted into benzyl. And then benzyl is converted into benzylic acid. So this is an experiment which spans 4 weeks that we've got here. But again, each one of those reactions needs to be filmed, viewed, talked about, discussed, and written up. And then the multi-step is written up as all one experiment. So we don't write up these individual parts. Each one of these parts is part of an overall total synthesis. And we talk about the differences in how to write a total synthesis paper. And I have things online that are set and ready for you, like the multi-step synthesis. It tells you what needs to be in the introduction, what needs to be in the experimental, what needs to be in the results, what to do in the discussion, what types of things to look for. And so there's lots of support information that is already here for you for some of these things. Once we get through the multi-step, traditionally we do the identification of an unknowns lab. And this is where I just have no idea how this is going to go. Zaruba has done this lab and has it pretty well defined in Canvas. Usually what we do is we have a set of like 200 unknowns and every student gets a unique unknown. The unknowns are among all different functional groups. Some of them are ketones, some of them are aldehydes, some of them are esters, carboxylic acids, alcohols. We have all different functional groups that are in there. And you have a series of tests. There's probably 30 or 40 different tests that are functional group determination tests that look to see either a functional group is there or not. In some cases, it can characterize the functional group. For instance, it can tell you whether it's a tertiary alcohol, a secondary alcohol, or a primary alcohol. And in some cases, some of the unknowns, being mean and dastardly as we are, have bifunctional, two functional groups on them, which just really mess with people. So we make sure that special students get those. And Zaruba has programmed that into Canvas so that I think there's like three or four unknowns that he has and he distributes those among the different students. I'm gonna try and do it a little bit differently. And while this semester is going on, I'm gonna try to program it into its own little app. And so that we have an application that was from the 80s and 90s that has since died. It runs only on old PCs, really old PCs. And I have all the data for it. And I've contacted the author of that software. And he's actually the author of our textbook, Pavia. And he gave me permission to try to reproduce it. He had none of the data himself, but he said if I could get the data out of the software, he didn't mind me at all reproducing the software. So I'm going to try and program it in Java and see if we can make a Java app that runs platform independent that will give us the ability to simulate that and do that with all of the unknowns. And that'll be much more interesting. So we'll see how that goes. That may not happen. It might, but it may not. We have lofty goals this semester. And then the Michael-Aldahl condensation. This is another multi-step, but it's unique in that we give you different materials than the textbook has, and you have to make those materials work. And the reason that we give you different materials is some of them have electron donating groups, some of them have electron withdrawing groups, and they accelerate or decelerate the reaction such that if you understand what's going on in your molecule, you can sort of predict what might happen. Although if you don't, you just jump into it blind, the reaction fails and you have to figure out why it fails and you have to figure out how to adjust to make the reaction actually work. And it turns out that electron donating groups slow this reaction down, and electron withdrawing reactions groups speed this reaction up greatly. And it just changes the amount of heat, it changes the length of time, it changes how much catalyst you need to use in order to make the reaction work. And so there's a bit of experimentation. You have to go off off the reservation, so to speak, in order to make it work, and or outside the box is a better analogy. I apologize. And going outside the box, it gets you ready for special projects where things often fail. And when things often fail, we need to fall back on the skill sets that we've learned all year to try to make things work. And so it just in a safe way provides you with some failure and some rethinking and restarting experience that is common within special projects. And all the time that we're doing that, traditionally, special projects start on day one. Traditionally, they start by people communicating, forming groups, tossing out ideas, talking to me, coming up with a group and several proposals, narrowing it down to a single proposal, and then coming up with not only the proposal, but I guess I should say idea. We come up with an idea, several ideas, we narrow it down to one idea, then we take that idea and turn that idea into a proposal, we order chemicals, and then we start the special projects. And all of that is happening and occurring while we're going through the rest of the semester. I think that we may take some time and talk about the computational component as we get closer to spring break and thinking about what it is we might want to do, but it doesn't require the same sort of time commitment that special projects usually do, because we don't have to simply order anything. We don't have to depend on materials coming in and approval of things that may be hazardous and dangerous, and making sure that everything is safe enough for us to work with in our lab and with our skill sets. So so that's the curriculum. That's my idea. That's my vision so far. And while not ideal, hopefully through the filming of the videos, it's better than what I have done in the past. And hopefully we make it work. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, something I didn't cover is in the syllabus, assessment. Whoa, too fast. Assessment traditionally for this class revolves around laboratory notebook, technique, what I actually physically see you doing in class, and the lab write-up that you do for the lab itself. And I would say that those are pretty much almost equal parts in terms of the way that I assess students in laboratory notebook, what I see you doing in the class, your technique, how you function, and your write-ups for those labs. A lot of that doesn't make sense right now because of the way that we're doing the lab. And I don't know exactly how many points there's going to be in lab, and I don't know exactly how it's going to work out. We're going to let it float a little bit. I have a proposal of how I'm going to try to do this, but to make that proposal work, I'm going to do it just straight points. However many points we offer during the semester, the grade will just be calculated out of those straight points, and it'll just be a straight percentage, and all points will be equal. So there won't be any weights on any of the individual experiments. And that's the best I can do right now. So it should be, the grading should be fairly simple. And traditionally students do very, very well in lab. And lab grades are generally A's and B's, and very few people ever get C's or D's or F's. The only way to get a lower grade in this class is to just simply not do it and not participate. That's generally my way of doing lab. Okay. All right. I think if there aren't any questions, I think that pretty much fills in the blanks for what I need to do there. And other than that, it's starting to talk about the lab itself, the first lab that we want to do. And I want to introduce the Grignard a little bit. I'm not going to go into great detail, but we can spend a half hour or so talking about the Grignard experiment itself and give you an idea of when you come back, what it is that we're going to be looking at in this Grignard chemistry. And it's very pertinent to lecture as well, because it's one of the first synthetic tools that we find that we start using in order to make carbon-carbon bonds within lecture, along with the alkynyl anions. They are complementary to the alkynyl anions, and they allow us to do things that we can't do with alkynyl anions in order to make new carbon-carbon bonds. So that's where we go with this. So let me stop this screen share and move it to screen share It is my iPad. And lab notes. And one more thing that I want to do. There we go. Okay. So what did I do this morning? We're doing Grignards. And the Grignard reaction was named after a French chemist who won the Nobel Prize. So Grignard was awarded the Nobel Prize in like 1912 was when Grignard got the Nobel Prize. And just to give you an overview of what it looks like before we jump in too far, a Grignard reaction takes an alkyl halide. So this chlorine could be a chlorine or a bromine or an iodine. Fluorine doesn't work so well, but the other halogens do. And we react it with a metal, magnesium, in its metallic state. So I use the little zero. This is the oxidation state. Being in a zero oxidation state, that means that this is metallic magnesium. And it requires an ether solvent in order for the reaction to work. And what happens is the metal oxidatively inserts in between the carbon-chlorine bond. And inserting in between the carbon-chlorine bond, the metal takes on a new oxidation state. It becomes 2+. The chloride becomes a minus, and the carbon at the point of attachment also becomes a minus. It becomes a carbanion. And so what happens here, when you look at this Grignard reaction, we start off with something that, let me put a carbon here. We start off with something that has a specific polarity to it, such that the carbon is partial positive and the chlorine is partial minus. And we would say that this carbon over here is electrophilic. It's an electrophile. And that happens because the chlorine is a strong electron withdrawing group, and it's sucking electron density out of that carbon. And so that carbon is partially positive and is looking for more electron density to backfill the hole that the chlorine has essentially left. When we do the reaction and we create a carbon bound to the magnesium and the chloride, the picture changes. The carbon now has a negative charge, a full negative charge. It's actually a carbanion. And as such, it's nucleophilic. Or it's a nucleophile. This is a complete reversal in the polarity that we saw at the beginning. So the polarity has now reversed and is going the opposite direction. This is what we call in organic chemistry an umplung. An umplung means reversal in polarity. And it's a way of taking electrophilic carbons and turning them into nucleophilic carbons. And once you have a nucleophilic carbon, then you can make carbon-carbon bonds. So it's a way of making carbon-carbon bonds. And that's the goal of the Grignard reagent, is to be able to make nucleophilic carbon to make carbon-carbon bonds. And so one of the things that you can do is you can take a molecule, perhaps, let's say CH3Cl. So this is chloromethane, and we can react it, number one, with magnesium metal in diethyl ether. And we can make the Grignard reagent. It's about to put a bromine in there, but we'll keep it chlorine. And then in a second reaction, we would take and react it with some electrophile. And then in the second step, we use dilute acid just to protonate things. And what we wind up creating is the negative charge comes in and attacks the partial positive carbon at the base of the carbonyl. That breaks the carbonyl bond, pushing electrons up onto the oxygen. That in turn makes that carbon a new bond and a negative charge to which the magnesium and the chloride are still with us as counterions. And then through protonation, the addition of acid, the acid will protonate that O minus charge, leading to a product, which in this case is a tertiary alcohol. And we've created a new carbon-carbon bond. So the Grignard reaction is a two-step process. It requires the making of the Grignard reagent first, and then using of the Grignard reagent to make a new carbon-carbon bond. So to that end, talking about Grignard, it's important to understand historically sort of where Grignard reaction comes from, and how this is different than what was known prior to Grignard, and why Grignard won the Nobel Prize. Why is this so important that Grignard won the Nobel Prize for this? That's a great question. So to understand that, we have to talk about Barbier. Philip Barbier, or Philippe Barbier, was a French chemist. He lived from 1848 to 1922. And Barbier did many organometallic reactions. Barbier had reactions that are still called today, they're called the Barbier reactions, where he would take an alkyl halide and some appropriate electrophile, something like an aldehyde or a ketone, and he would react them with zinc. And this was done in a solvent such as THF with water. This one had a salt in it, and I'm not sure exactly, must be for solubility reasons, why that salt needed to be included. It was done at room temperature for 4.5 hours. And at the end of the reaction, he would make new carbon-carbon bonds, much in the same way that the Grignard reaction does. So if we count this out and we look at kind of where things are, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, and 3, this piece of the molecule here is right there up to the third carbon. This is the new bond. And then if we take this piece here and count out the four carbons that are there, I need one more carbon in my molecule. There's the four carbons. Let's denote this one as 1', 2', 3', and 4'. There is 1', 2', 3', and 4'. So what I'm trying to model is that whenever you're doing organic chemistry, numbering is a key thing to not making a mistake. As you go through and you number each one of the steps and you number the molecule from beginning to end, it allows you to make many less mistakes than if you don't number. And this is the new bond that we wind up creating. Okay, so how is this different? He used zinc. Well, the metals that Barbier used. Metals included zinc, indium, samarium, magnesium, aluminum, and tin. Barbier did many, many different reactions, but all of these reactions were done in situ. So I use, you got to get used to me a little bit here in some of these things. I use RxN, this equals reaction. Some abbreviations that I use as I'm writing things quickly. RxN, so reaction done what is called in situ. In situ means in one pot. It literally translates into in one pot. You can think of this as making a pot roast or making a soup. You throw everything into one pot, you turn it on, and you know, half an hour later, you've got soup. It's just magic. There's not a whole lot to it. That's the way Barbier reactions were done. Barbier reactions were done by combining the electrophile, the electrophile, what becomes the nucleophile, and the solvent, and throwing it all into one pot, and you run it, and you get your product. Because it was done in situ, because it was done in one pot, it limited the types of molecules that I could use for the electrophiles. It limited how things could be done. And because these metals, some of them extremely reactive, some of them less reactive, made it difficult to do it in any other way than in doing it in one pot. Now, Philip Barbier was the professor and Grignard was the student. Grignard was Barbier's graduate student, essentially, and earned his postdoctorate degree, or earned his doctorate degree under Barbier. But it was Grignard who won the Nobel Prize. So what did Grignard do different than Barbier? Because you see that here, even in Barbier, Barbier was doing magnesium, but Barbier was doing them all in situ. And what Grignard did was Grignard did them in two steps. This is the best way to do it here. First step, making the Grignard reagent. Second step, reacting the Grignard reagent. This gave the Grignard reagent more flexibility. And not only did it give it more flexibility, but a Grignard reagent could now be commercially made and sold to be able to do the second half of the reaction. So there was actually a commercial product that was there. And there's one other really big difference between Barbier and Grignard. So when we look at Grignard, the Grignard reaction is extremely general. When we say that a reaction is general, what we mean is it tolerates many different types of substrates. So the substrates that this works on, when we look at this reaction and say, oh, I can do RX, react with magnesium, and I can make R magnesium X, and that's the Grignard reagent. What R can be is almost anything. It's really quite astounding. R can be an alkyl group. It can be an alkane. So this is an sp3 center that I'm looking at in terms of the center that's right there that the alkyl halide is attached to. R can be a double bond with a halide on it. And so it can be alkenyl, or what we would say, actually that's not the best way to say it, vinyl. Is the best way to say it. That's the vinyl position, or this is a vinylic chloride. So that's the best way to do this. So this can be an alkene. And this center then is in SP2. It can be propargyl. So let's use a bromide instead. And actually, I don't think that's the propargylic position. This one has another name, which I can't remember. Let's say that it can be alkyne. And so this can be SP hybridized. And it also tolerates aromatics. So this is SP2. Doesn't look any different than the other SP2, but the fact that it's aromatic means that this is unique from the other SP2 hybridized type of reagent. And all of these can form Grignard reagents, and they do it easily. It's very facile. And they all work exactly the same way. And it was that versatility that you could do this with any sort of alkyl halide that made this so synthetically useful. And the fact that it could be done in two steps so that it could be added to an electrophile down the road made it even more useful. And that's why Grignard won the Nobel Prize for this, was because of its utility, its ability to be able to do all different sorts of reactions. Not only this, but it can do intramolecular reactions as well as intermolecular reactions. So one of the things that it can do too is that we can take substrates, as an example, we can take a substrate that has an electrophile built into it. And you have to be careful with most molecules. If you want this to happen, you plan for it. Sometimes this happens when you don't plan for it, if you're not careful, that when we go through and do the Grignard, that this will go through an intermediate exactly as we expect. So this is formed very fleetingly, but you now have a carbanion that sits at this position and a built-in electrophile, and it cyclizes and reacts with itself. And after we would do one magnesium, we would do two dilute acid in order to protonate the resulting anion that comes from this. And we wind up making, I think I sort of drew that incorrectly initially. Let's do it this way. We wind up making a cyclic molecule. So if we go through and we number where things are located, let's start number one at the anion, 2, 3, 4, 5 will be the carbon that we're connected to, and 6 will be that terminal end. 1 is the carbon, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 out of the terminal end of the methyl, and the new carbon-carbon bond that we have formed is between 1 and 5. And so you can do reactions within a molecule as easily as you can do reactions between two molecules. It's an incredibly versatile tool for making new carbon-carbon bonds. Some limitations and some understandings. So some of the things that we need to understand first off is, I said that this was a challenging experiment to do, and I think you heard me say that it's very sensitive to water, and that we need to be careful in how we handle the glassware and how we handle these reagents to protect from water. Why do we have to be so careful of water? Well, let's understand a little bit about the molecule itself that we're creating, the Grignard reagent itself. So understanding the Grignard. In order to understand the nature of Grignard, we have to understand the nature of some other very common things so that we have some reference frame to compare it to. Let's start with water. When we look at water, we know that water is amphoteric. Remember that word? Have you heard that word before, amphoteric? Amphoteric means something that can be both an acid and a base. So water can be a base, it can pick up a proton, in which case it becomes hydronium, or water can lose a proton acting as an acid to become hydroxide. And if we look at the acidity of water, the pKa of water is 15.7. And when water loses a proton acting as an acid, it becomes its conjugate base hydroxide. And so we have the acid and we have the conjugate base. Okay, when we look at those two, there's a relationship between an acid and a conjugate base. And in fact, if you compare acids and we look at the relative strength of an acid, the stronger an acid, the weaker its conjugate base. Okay, so where does water sit in this scheme of things? When we think about hydroxide, is hydroxide a strong base? What have you been taught about hydroxide? Do you remember what your strong bases were? You can always use the chat or you can unmute if you're feeling brave.
It's a strong base.
It is a strong base, yeah. And in fact, it's the strongest base that you've worked with. So you haven't worked with a base stronger than hydroxide ever. Hydroxide has been sort of our, you know, pedestal A number one winning gold medal strong base. That's what a strong base is. We gauge everything against hydroxide. So if hydroxide is a strong base, then I kind of have it in the wrong place. On this table, it should be down near the strong base and weak acid. And as another reference, we can put another reference in here. Let's use a reference of acetic acid. So this one, acetic acid, and it has a pKa of right around 4.5. And its conjugate base is acetate anion. You can think of this as sodium acetate. Sodium acetate, because of, here's another good thing, you guys have already had OCHEM, so we can talk about this. This has the resonance with the negative charge bouncing back and forth between the two oxygens. We have a negative charge on one oxygen versus a negative charge spread on resonance between two oxygens. That makes that a much weaker base when the negative charge is delocalized over two oxygens, right? Recall these terms are making sense. So we know that acetate is a weaker base than hydroxide. And that makes sense because if this is a stronger acid, then acetate, its conjugate, should be a weaker base than hydroxide. Okay, now remember that the pKa scale is a logarithmic scale. We're taking minus the log of the Ka. So this is orders of magnitude different between these two. Let's take a Grignard. A Grignard is a carbon proton, a carbon acid. The pKa on this carbon acid is 60. So that means that when it gets converted into its Grignard, I'm now dealing with this guy, CH3 minus. Okay, now follow me, orders of magnitude difference. At 15 pKa, I had hydroxide, which was a strong base. Back it up 10 pKa units, and I'm at a strong acid, a pretty strong acid, acetic acid, and a really weak conjugate base. Move it forward now, what, 45 units? Something insane? Do you know how strong a base that thing is? That thing is off the charts crazy strong. That thing, when it sees a proton, that carbon ion, when it sees a proton, will take that proton from almost anything that it can. It will take that proton from moisture in the air. it will take that proton from a water molecule, an alcohol, an acid. It'll take that proton from an alkyne. It will take that proton from anything, just about, that is a weaker base than it is. And so this is a crazy strong base. And so when you make a Grignard, you need to be careful, because what you're making is you're making a crazy strong base. You're making essentially a carbanion, and it needs to be handled and treated appropriately. And you need to understand its nature and how it reacts and how to handle it correctly. So Grignard reagents like this, the main threat to a Grignard reagent is water. Water vapor in any manner destroys a Grignard reaction. And as the Grignard gets made, as soon as it finds water, it takes the proton from the water and it does what's called quench. It destroys the active reagent. So what happens is that when we make a Grignard, we make the Grignard, and the anion, when it sees water, will take that proton, and what you will get is you will get the hydrocarbon. And you will get hydroxide and the counter ions of magnesium 2+ and the chloride or bromide, depending upon what it is you've got there. And what this is called is a quench. It quenches the reaction. It stops the reaction from progressing. It destroys the reagent. And that water happens to show up in glassware, because when we look at the surface of a glass, let's say it's a round bottom, glass is silicon dioxide. So when we take a little view here and we kind of blow it up, what we have is we have alternating silicon and oxygen and silicon and oxygen in a pattern that repeats. And the lone pairs on that oxygen allow it to hydrogen bond with water. And so the glass is hydrophilic. And we need to take great pains to remove that water vapor from the glass itself. And so what we typically do when we get ready to do a Grignard reaction or any organometallic reaction similar to a Grignard is we always scrupulously dry the glassware, generally leaving it in an oven at 110 degrees or 115 degrees for 24 hours before we use it. And then when we do use it, we're very careful to assemble that glassware quickly and in a manner that does not let water get back into the glassware. And that's part of what I will show you in the demonstration and talk a lot about when we go through and I actually film that and how we put it together and how we avoid getting water out of there. But like I said, basically what we do is we have special glassware ovens, and those glassware ovens just look like a big thing with a door on it. They have a hole in the top, and out of that is a thermometer that comes out, and we're generally looking for a temperature in here that's around 110, 115 in 24 hours. To remove all water.
So you mentioned that the water hydrogen bonds to the glass.
Yes.
So like I'm looking at my grandpa's car right now and I'm watching it all bleed. So I'm guessing like Rain-X is like products like that disrupt the hydrogen bonding between the
silicon. Yeah. Well, I think that there's other things that wind up happening with the windshield. It's not just that the windshield is hydrophilic. It's that dirt and grease on the window actually make it more hydrophilic and make the water really stick. And so that Rain-X that goes on there both is a hydrophobic coating that goes on the glass, but the glass has to be clean of all that other stuff. Regular glass would sheet water just fine if it didn't also pick up all that dirt. So yeah, that Rain-X stuff is a hydrophobic coating that's going over the top of the glassware. And there's other ways that we dry glassware too. One of the ways that we dry glassware is generally to take and to flame dry it over a Bunsen burner. And what's really neat when you do this is that when you flame dry it, what you can see immediately when you turn it on is that you'll see condensation on the top of the glassware, because what winds up happening is the H2O, which is adhering down here. So we have the water, which is liquid attached to the glass, gets converted into water, which is gaseous. And then that water condenses on the surface, which is cool up on top relative to the rest of the glassware. And you'll see a fog happen on the top of the glassware. And until you get rid of that fog by rotating the glassware and heating it on all sides, you haven't really gotten the water vapor out of it. And you need to be careful that you chase all the water out and that the glassware gets heated evenly all the way around. Yes, JC, under the reaction arrow, it was ET2O. Let me go back to that. That is correct, ET2O. So I use a number of abbreviations. ET2O means an ethyl group bound to an oxygen, bound to an ethyl group, or more formally, it would be this, which is diethyl ether. It's a common abbreviation which is used for a solvent that we use all the time, ET2O. We could do ME2O. Do you know what that is?
Methyl.
Dimethyl ether, exactly. And so this one would be just the methyl ether. Some other things that we abbreviate is ETOAC. This one is an ethyl group and an acetate group. This is ethyl acetate. So this is, if I do it correctly, this would be the ETO, and this is the acete group, or the ester. And so there are several abbreviations that we use very commonly for certain organic molecules. I generally, when I'm in lab, the first day of lab, I almost always introduce all of these. And so forgive me, I know that you guys didn't have me for first semester. So if I put any abbreviations, I'm just kind of working off what I would normally do. If I put any abbreviations down that you don't recognize, let me know. And I will certainly take a second and clue you in on some of those abbreviations. Okay. Trying to think if there's anything else I want to get into, and I don't think so. I think I've pretty much hit everything I want to do today. I'll leave the rest of outlining the actual experiment for Thursday, and we'll take it easy today. How does that sound? We'll slow start it a little bit. Okay. Any questions come up as we're going through things? You're getting an idea of how I like to lecture and how I draw notes and being able to keep up with me.
Will you upload the lab videos to your website too?
They'll either go on the website or they'll go on Canvas or they'll go on both. I'm thinking what I'll probably do is I'll probably post them on my website because that's easier for me to control. And then I'll link to them from Canvas, so that you'll see them in the module and just be linked to them that way. I think that's probably the best way to go with that. Okay. Anything else?
Hi, sorry, Jason. I just had a quick question. It's more just like asking your advice, just like having gone through like working in a chemistry lab and stuff, because a lot of us are having our entire organic chemistry class online. Yeah. And that's what I'm doing. And I'm a chemical engineering major, and I'm about to transfer to hopefully somewhere, UCSD, fingers crossed. And basically, like, this class is not required, actually. Chem 12A and Chem 12B aren't, but I was like, hey, they're, you know, chemistry classes, and that's like the major. So I'm like wondering whether or not you think it'd be valuable, like, how much lab skills did you really get from your organic chemistry sequence? Like, because, like, going on in the future, like, I know I'm going to need laboratory skills, but, like, is it to an extent where I can recover them in another lab class probably, or, like, when I transfer, should I, like, opt to retake just the lab section of, like, 12A or 12B? And, like, what would your advice be if even choosing between the two?
Man, that is such a good question. And I don't entirely know the answer to that. So what I would say is that my lab curriculum that I've developed here at Cabrillo is probably one of the most aggressive lab curriculums because of the special projects that we do. I don't know any other school that does special projects in the way that we've done it at Cabrillo and the way that I've done it for 20 years. And before I did it, the reason that I did it is because my professor, Harry Unger at Cabrillo, when I went through, did special projects. And so that was the curriculum. That's what I was handed. Harry and I worked very closely together, and it just seemed like the right thing to do. And I've never seen a student more motivated by doing their own project. And when we do special projects, I find that students not only attend their lab section, they try to attend every lab section that I offer, sometimes cutting out of other classes because they're trying to make that project work and they're just invested in it and they're making it go. And so sometimes we have to have conversations and, like, okay, that timeout. So I got to slow down here. I'm very happy with everything that you've done. You have an A, you can let it go now. It's okay. And sometimes that doesn't even work. But so when you come out of my class and Zarubas, because we teach the same lab curriculum, I generally consider you to have lab skills almost on par with a graduate student and sometimes surpassing certain graduate students, that you may not have the breadth of skills that a graduate student would have, but you have the ability to work in a lab and handle yourself at a graduate level. You could easily walk into any undergraduate laboratory and do research and be comfortable and not have them have to worry about watching you every step and messing something up. That is a huge loss in terms of a skill set moving forward. So I acknowledge that. Trying to find a place to be able to pick that up depends on your pathway. It depends on, if you're a chemistry major, the next classes that you would take after transfer are upper division classes such as advanced organic laboratory, advanced inorganic laboratory, quantitative analysis. All of these labs are going to teach good lab skills and teach different sorts of lab skills, but you would definitely pick up the lab skills that you would need by going into those classes. And so, so that would be there. Other paths besides a chemistry major, if you're going into biology, there will be biology labs where you will be getting different lab skills in working in bio, but having lost out on some of those more technical sort of chemistry skills. In the engineering area, I don't know that you have many labs actually left moving forward. In that curriculum, it's mostly non-lab classes. So to pick up that lab experience is harder. And I think the thing that we're going to have to realize as instructors across the board is, like, what do I do when I come back in maybe next fall or next spring and I get that first class that's coming in that hasn't had a lab experience yet? They've gone through Chem 1A, they've gone through Chem 1B, and they haven't been in a lab at all. How am I going to deal with them in Chem 12 and teaching them how to go through and do everything? And of those instructors where you transfer, the burden is going to be on them to think through those things as well. They will have to modify their curriculum to some degree in order to get you the skills. So that's just going to be a given. And as a society, as academia, we're going to have to manage that in the sciences and in STEM and in having a generation of students that have come through without strong lab skills. And I think you will pick them up. And I think that you will have opportunities to learn them. It is a loss, and it will be something that you'll have to actively pursue in order to try to gain them. So I think that's the best answer I can give you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, anything else? All right, let's call it a day. If anybody wants to hang on and ask me anything individually, I'll be here. Otherwise, I'll see you guys on Thursday.
Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. BB, do you have a question?
Kind of. It's kind of embarrassing.
Okay.
I guess I was wondering how much math is going to be involved in lecture or lab.
Almost none in lecture and a smidge in lab. It's really, you know, you've done some stoichiometric conversions where you've converted grams into moles, maybe even converted things into millimoles. That's really the extent of what we do. Maybe a little bit of concentration in acids, moles per liters, or maybe a conversion of a dilution conversion, taking a concentrated one molar acid and converting it down into a half molar or something. There's very little math that's in this class. It's just organic chemistry is not, there are branches and areas of organic chemistry where you can get very math intensive, but for the most part, the general organic chemistry curriculum has almost no math in it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's not my strong suit. I never took math.
How did you get those math prerequisites with all the classes? How did you get there?
I already have an undergrad degree. So I white lied because my undergraduate degree is in printmaking and stone lithography. So we took like weird art math.
How did you sneak in here, you artist?
They were like, well, because I'm working right now I'm technically working on pre-grad requisites for a master's in conservation chemistry for art. So awesome. It's this weird thing where I'm not really a chemistry major, but I'm a chemistry major. Yeah, it's cool.
I'm shocked. Okay, so you're in the right place. I live in a household full of artists. My dad, my father was a graphic designer. My wife is a landscape painter, and together we do 3D art. My daughter's a graphic design major. You're in good company. So
thank you.
So yes, when we get to anything mathematical, just flag me or come and jump into office hours, but there's very little. You're not gonna have to do much. And if you've weathered Chem 1A and Chem 1B, Chem 1B would have been really hard. Chem 1B is pretty math intensive.
Albie loves math.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so good. The only thing I really struggle with is rearranging equations, but okay. I can do it after that.
Okay, none of that. We don't have any of that.
Okay, cool.
We're pretty good on that.
And then I was wondering if you had any tips, or I don't even know if it'll be a problem, but I'm the SI instructor for Zaruba's 12A class.
Yeah, you emailed me.
Yeah, I was wondering if any other people who had done that in the past had trouble balancing your class and SI, or if it was fine. It seems like online it might be easy because everything's uploaded.
Yeah, I don't see a problem with it. I think that it's really going to be up to you in managing your time and taking a look. If you start running into trouble, we're all pretty flexible. And I think, you know, if there's an exam coming up and you want to study for that exam and you want to push off something from SI and they don't have an immediate exam and they're not desperate, that's not an unreasonable request to skip out on a section or two when you're really crunched for time. And I think you'll just have to sort of monitor and see how it goes. But okay. In general, if Zaruba is feeding you materials, you shouldn't have to really prep materials on your own.
Yeah.
And that should cut down on your preparation time. I usually, for my SI leaders, I always give, I both give a binder that has materials and has solutions, but then I'm oftentimes supplementing that and saying, all right, here's some more targeted things and these are the answers for it, and go ahead and work off of these. So hopefully Zaruba does the same sort of thing.
Yeah, I think he has practice problems and the answers that we'll see. I've never even been to SI, so it'll be fun.
It'll be fun. Did you get contacted by, I'm trying to remember her name now, there's a woman from UCSC who is in charge of the Access program, and they do a little training for the new SI leaders, particularly if somebody hasn't done Anita? SI before.
Maybe. Somebody said they would meet with me.
And you haven't done it yet?
No, because they got sick or something. So it was, I don't know.
Okay.
But
typically with SI, what we typically do is we generally teach the SI leaders to treat it like a study session where we hand out materials for the students to work on, and then to come around individually and work with the students to help them see the solutions or to figure out what they're doing right or wrong. In a Zoom sort of session, you could do the same sort of thing, putting out the material, and then you could either use a breakout room or you could just do it in live in front of everybody helping with the different questions. Some students in SI feel more comfortable working in a lecture format where they'll take and they'll give several examples and treat it as if it's a lecture, and then put up 3 or 4 or 5 problems and let the students work through them and kind of walk around and help them individually. And so it really is whatever you're comfortable with. You make it what it is that you're willing to do and willing to work within that framework of what makes you comfortable.
Okay.
So a lot of flexibility.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It'll be fun.
Okay. And I think that they're having the SI leaders generally use the STEM MESA Center and the links in the STEM MESA Center to set up the tutoring sessions where the students would log into. Has that been your experience?
I haven't done it yet. The first session I'm holding is on Friday. Okay. But yeah, I think it's through the STEM Center, and then they place all of us in a breakout room.
Okay.
Whoever shows up.
Okay. So you've had somebody from the STEM Center contact you or not?
Yes.
Okay.
I still have to fill out the paperwork because I only met 5 units. So Zaruba like made an extra class.
Good.
That I'm taking.
Good. Generally we do that as a special studies, as a 1-unit special studies. And your time doing SI just fills that bill, and we don't need you to do anything else. So Zaruba sounds like he took care of it. He's taking care of you.
Yeah, it's like an invented art and chemistry class where I have to bring papers about art chemicals and art materials and talk through the reactions taking place. It'll be cool because that's all that I bother chemistry teachers about anyways.
Okay. Sounds awesome. All right. Well,
thank you so much. I'm excited to be in your class.
Thank you. I'm welcome. I'm excited to have you. This is fantastic. It'll be fun. It'll be a good semester.
I hope so. I think so.
Okay. All right. Take care.
You too.
Bye.